Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC podcasts are supported by Holy Name Hospital in Teaneck, New Jersey, providing comprehensive centers in cardiovascular services, interventional radiology, and cancer care. More information at www.holyname.org.
This is Soundcheck at 93.9 WNYC and online at WNYC.org. I'm John Schaefer. Arts funding is back on the chopping block in New Jersey. With just 2 weeks to go before Governor John Corzine has to submit a budget and faced with a huge deficit, he's proposing cutting Arts Council funding by about $2.5 million. Arts advocates say this could significantly impact the 118 organizations that receive state funds. But New Jersey's not alone. And with so many states plagued with budget problems in recent years, it raises some big questions about government's role in supporting the arts. We'll get several opinions on this today. To begin, joining us on the phone is Lawrence Goldman, the president and CEO of NJPAC, the New Jersey Performing Arts Center in Newark. Larry, good to speak with you again.
Hi, John. Happy to be here.
So in 2003, it sounds like history repeating itself, but in 2003, then-Governor James McGreevy proposed slashing the state arts budget by $18 million. You ended up meeting with McGreevy, and what was the result of that?
Not just me, John. All of the arts groups in New Jersey banded together and essentially formed an alliance to get restoration. It's also a major difference between what Governor McGreevy did, which was to zero out the arts, and what Governor Corzine has proposed, which is a modest decrease in the face of a huge budget problem that he's facing in Trenton.
Uh-huh. So there won't be a similar mobilization to head to Trenton this time around.
No, I think that would be hugely insensitive.
Yeah. So what was the result of your meeting with James McGreevy back then?
Well, it wasn't just the meeting. We really took it upon ourselves to mount a campaign. We had what we called curtain speeches, where at the New Jersey Performing Arts Center here on the stage of Prudential Hall and at MacArthur Theater and the Paper Mill Playhouse, all around the state, before every single performance, we asked the audience to please let the governor and the legislators know what they thought about cutting out the arts. And they did that, and they did it magnificently, and it led to a virtually full restoration of the arts budget.
Wow. Now, NJPAC was built on state funding, correct?
Partially.
Partially.
The New Jersey Performing Arts Center, which is by budget size the sixth largest in the United States, was built with about two-thirds public funding and one-third private funding. It was a genuine partnership between both sectors.
Do you still need government support today?
Yes, we do. And we're not getting enough of it. When you buy a ticket at the New Jersey Performing Arts Center to see the symphony or to attend dance or to see Peter, Paul, and Mary, your ticket price doesn't cover or even nearly cover the cost of the performances. And it doesn't cover for sure the arts education and the community building that we're doing in Newark, Essex County, and throughout the state.
Right. Now, we're speaking with Lawrence Goldman. He's the president and CEO of the New Jersey Performing Arts Center in Newark. Now, you mentioned it's the sixth largest of its kind. The Bergen Star Ledger reports that NJPAC gets 30 cents of every corporate dollar that's donated in the state. And the other 117 groups have to split what's left. Is there just too much competition for a decreasing pool of money out there?
Well, there's a lot of competition, that's for sure. Since we opened in 1997, there have been 13 new performing arts centers or major restorations of performing arts centers in other New Jersey towns and cities. Mm-hmm. So it really has come to a point where every municipality feels that it needs to have a performing arts center. And that has, as you say, created some competition.
All right. in addition to speaking with Lawrence Goldman across the river in Newark, New Jersey, across the table from me here in the studio is Alice Goldfarb Marquis. She is author of, among other books, Art Lessons, Learning from the Rise and Fall of Public Arts Funding, an inside look at the NEA. Alice, let me bring you into the discussion here. You suggest in Art Lessons that quantity drives out quality. That, you know, just the sheer volume of artists, presenters, organizations competing for this limited pool is doing art a disservice.
Yes, I think that's true. And the beginning of public funding for the arts was in 1965 when the federal government founded the National Endowment for the Arts, and then the state arts councils got money to distribute within each state. The purpose of federal funding at that time was the Cold War. There was a drive to compete with the Soviet Cultural Offensive, where they sent their ballet companies, et cetera, operas around the country. And so that was the motivation. Of course, now the Cold War is over. And there is a question in my mind as to how much the government should do or could do.
Hmm. So the idea of declining government support for the arts, you don't see particularly as much of a problem as obviously somebody like Larry in at NJPAC would.
No, I don't. This competitive situation is certainly troubling. It's awfully hard to have a year-round season for a symphony orchestra, except, of course, in New York or Chicago or places like that. But otherwise, they're just the audience tires, especially when there are also many competing chamber groups and
to say nothing of television.
And to say nothing of television, right, right.
So, I mean, it's competition on many, many levels.
Yes,
it's
it is.
It's competition for time and attention as well as
right.
dollars.
And the thing is that in the United States, there's a tax deduction for private donations. These corporations do get a tax deduction, and individuals get a tax deduction. And because of that encouragement, there are about $11 billion spent devoted to donations to arts in this country, which is very similar per capita to what other governments spend mm-hmm. in Europe, actually.
All right. So, Alice, is it then your contention that that a decrease in government support for the arts is actually a benefit?
It might be, because some arts organizations want to do what they want to do, even if there is not much of an audience for that particular thing. And I think it would make them more audience-oriented if they had to depend on the audience for mm-hmm. their funding.
But there certainly has been a lot of examples in the history of art of things that were not, you know, sort of considered audience-friendly and turned out to be quite important.
Right, right. And I think a lot of the abuses that were discovered on the part of the NEA have now been mitigated. There are no more individual grants to individual artists, which was a revolving door.
Right, so it's mostly to presenters and things
like that. To presenters, yes. Okay. And I think the aid to presenters for their business operations, that would also be a good thing to fund, because
okay.
many of them don't manage very well.
Let's get an opinion from the other side of the Atlantic. Also with us on the phone is our good friend Norman Lebrecht, the British cultural critic and columnist for the London Evening Standard. He, too, has argued that the arts may be better off without government subsidy. Norman, first of all, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Hi, good to be with you, John.
So you heard what Alice was just saying.
I did indeed. Made a lot of sense.
So you agree, basically.
Well, I'm not saying without government subsidy. I'm saying mm-hmm. with less government subsidy. Mm-hmm. I think there are currents that are going through several countries at the moment which suggest that we are in for a serious reexamination of the state's role in the arts, and I would say not a moment too soon. What we're looking at historically is three models. In Europe, historically, the royal courts used to subsidize the arts, and when the court became the state simply took over that role of patronage. In the United States, there was no such tradition, there was no state involvement until, as Alice said, in the mid-1960s, under the chill of the Cold War, and also some fear of other companies that were visiting the United States on a regular basis. You know, it wasn't just the Bolshoi, it was the Royal Ballet that was putting a lot of American ballet companies under pressure. The United States government founded the National Endowment for the Arts, and soon after that was followed by the Ford Foundation, and we started witnessing some fairly serious state involvement and corporate involvement in the funding of the arts. The third model is the British model. We had neither state nor corporate involvement until 1945, when the economist Maynard Keynes said we were a bankrupt nation, and the only way to regenerate was through tapping the cultural resources. He proposed an arts council. It was funded originally with £50,000. Out of that £50,000 grew a Royal Opera House, a Royal Shakespeare Company, a National Theatre, all manner of things that had never existed before. It was phenomenally successful, but today that £50,000 is £300 million, which is something like $550 million. And there are vast institutions that have become used to feeding off the state cow for subsidy. The Royal Opera House, which was initially started on £25,000, now gets £30 million. It is a company in very good shape, and it is not one of those that I would describe as complacent, but others have simply settled into institutional palsy, taking for granted that the money that they get from the state and really performing accordingly. And that's a disease that we don't just see in Britain. I mean, we see it in the United States. Every year I follow the deliberations of the beautifully named ASOL, which is the Association of Symphony Orchestras League.
The American Symphony Orchestra League, yes.
Indeed. And I see there the seeds of the same complacency and self-satisfaction, the same assumption that the sources of funding, whether corporate and state, will continue to come their way so they can carry on performing the same routines year in, year out. The arts need perpetual shake-up. We do need constantly to re-examine ourselves and to re-examine our sources of funding. And I think there is a current that's running through the arts at the moment and through politics that leads to this. And one of the things that confirmed it to me was that in November I went to Sweden, which is the eiderdown, the quilt of state funding, the nanny state, where companies are funded with up to 80 or 85% of their budget from the state pocket. And I preached to the heads of the major performing institutions a post-subsidy model, which they quite willingly accepted. I think they realize, even in Sweden, that we're coming to the end of feather bedding.
All right. Well, maybe I can ask you to be a little more specific about what that post-subsidy model might look like in just a moment. But I also want to bring Lawrence Goldman back into the conversation. And I also just want to play a little piece of music because, you know, actually, Norman, the British model starts off sounding pretty good to me. And there are lots of examples of music like this piece from the very gifted English composer Thomas Addis that wouldn't exist without funding from the Arts Council there in Britain. Thomas Addis's string quartet called Arcadiana, commissioned with funds from the Arts Council in the UK. We are talking about government subsidies for the arts, both here and abroad. Joining me across the table is author Alice Goldfarb Marquis. Her most recent book is called Art Czar, The Rise and Fall of Clement Greenberg, and she's also the author of Art Lessons, Learning from the Rise and Fall of Public Arts Funding. Across the river in New Jersey is Lawrence Goldman, president and CEO of the New Jersey Performing Arts Center. And across the pond in England is Norman Lebrecht, leading British cultural critic and columnist for the London Evening Standard. Larry, in Newark, let me bring you back into the conversation here. I mean, isn't there, despite whatever points Norman and Alice have made, isn't there something to be said for the signal that it sends for a government to be supporting the arts, a signal that, you know, culture is recognized as important and has, you know, a kind of a pride of place?
More than a signal. Certainly the signal is important, but it's palpable. I think that enlightened institutions like the New Jersey State Council on the Arts, which is one of the best arts councils in the country, feel that public funds to the arts is not a gift, putting us on the dole, as Norman was implying, but an investment. I'd like to spend a second talking about what some of the yields on that investment might be. First of all, it's hard to imagine a city having vitality and excitement and the kind of electricity that New York and so many other cities have, London, without the arts. And just the quality of life, why people come. Richard Florida has written in his book on the creative class that successful cities tend to be cities that have lots of investment in the arts. Secondly, children. In Newark, beyond Newark, there are kids who simply don't have the opportunity of parents paying for music lessons like my parents did, or sending them to ballet class. Kids learn in different ways. Howard Gardner at Harvard taught us that in Multiple Intelligences, his book. I had a daughter who was kind of struggling to find herself in high school until she joined a jazz band. Kids get turned on and plugged in different ways, and the arts are one important way, and without public subsidy, this simply wouldn't happen.
All right, now that you're talking, now you've gotten into, you know, the realm of education, and Norman, let me throw it back to you. That seems to me potentially a different kettle of fish entirely.
I think that's a different argument. All my life I've been a strong supporter of state funding. I grew up on state funding. I've benefited from it. The first operas, the first concerts, the first theaters I ever went to were in a very large part state funding. But I don't think anything remains static. I think we do need to move on. And the state has moved on, because where in the past state monies were given independently and at arm's length, now there are strings attached, and one of those strings is education. As the state has withdrawn from arts education and cultural education in the United States 40 years ago, in Britain 20 years ago, in Western Europe a decade ago, the state is requiring performing arts organizations and museums, visual arts organizations, to take over the role of cultural education. Now, that may be partly justified, but I don't think it's wholly justified, unless the state plays its own part and unless education is taken back into schools as much what the best work that whatever the best work that arts organizations can do will never be the same as classroom teaching and classroom enlightenment. So that is part of the equation. The other part, of course, is that the state is seeking to use the arts as a kind of enforcer of multiculturalism, as a monitor of social progress, as a box ticker, as a collector of statistics, as a filler of forms. Many of the organizations that I talk to and that I deal with that have either received less state funding or withdrawn from as close a relationship with the state as they once had, have found a great deal of artistic independence that they never had before. They feel great relief that they no longer have the commissars on their shoulder. If you run an opera house in Germany, you actually have a state official sitting in the adjacent room telling you what you can and what you can't do. And many of the intendants, the general directors of the opera houses, feel quite comfortable with that because, you know, they know that their major plans, if they are shot down, they stand no blame themselves. They say, "Well, it's the senior civil servant who won't allow me to do it." And if they do succeed, then they can take credit. So that's a pretty good way to operate. But for an independent arts environment, for a developing progressive culture, that's no way to operate.
Right. All right. Now, Alice, let me ask you. I mean, how is that different from the NEA dealing with, you know, congressional conservatives during the mid-1990s.
Well, the congressional conservatives, I think, were a red herring. There were a lot of really disreputable performances that were funded. There was a group in New York that brought a Times Square prostitute to its theater, and she described and illustrated what she does with her clients. And there was a man in Los Angeles who peed into a toilet on stage. This kind of thing really turns the general public, the average taxpayer off. I think one of the problems that Larry Goldman is suffering from is the enormous proliferation of trained people in the arts. Universities are turning out huge quantities of actors with advanced degrees, of artists with an MFA, of dancers, and all sorts of performers, and of course musicians, all sorts of people who normally, before the Second World War, would have been trained at a conservatory.
Mm-hmm.
And with a limited number of people. Now, we have half, in the United States, we have half the symphony orchestras in the world. And they, all the musicians
but,
there.
Yeah, you're saying this as a bad thing.
Well, I think, I think it's a good thing, but you have to consider that there is never going to be a 100% of the public who wants to attend a classical music concert. It's not mm-hmm. going to happen.
Right.
So there are many.
But for the percentage that's there, they should have a symphony orchestra available.
Yes,
to them.
And I think we are in an age of performance. I think the string quartet that you played demonstrates that composition is not on the highest level, except maybe in jazz. Performance is where I think this is a great age of performance in mm-hmm. all the arts.
And performance is something that is different, and I would argue more civilization building than iPods and
yes.
computer screens and text messaging. And without the help of government subsidy from all levels of government, there's a risk of disappearing from our society, live performance. And all you have to do is watch children watching live performance and then watch children lobotomously watching television to see and understand why it's important to keep this going in our society. And I tell you, without this kind of help from government, from the private sector, from corporations, it's not going to happen. And there's something about a civil society, in my view, that requires that we keep this flame alive.
All right, Larry, you heard Norman Lebrecht talking about, the German opera house, the regional opera house with the senior civil servant in the next office sort of, saying yay or nay to the various projects. How much of the government, of the state support that you get, that other arts organizations in your state get, comes with either de facto or implied strings attached?
I never thought I could find an area where we would be better than Europe in the subsidy of the arts, but I spent 8 years as the vice president of Carnegie Hall, and I've spent 17 years as the president of the New Jersey Performing Arts Center in Newark, and I cannot cite for you a single incident, not one, of anybody telling us what to put on our stage or, for that matter, how to design our building or run our property or anything else. It has all been hands-off with total respect for the professionals and for the artistic process.
All right, then, Alice.
Can I come back
from
that job?
I actually wanted to get you back in. Let me just give Alice a moment here, Norman,
sure.
And then back to you.
What has happened, however, is that the performers themselves, especially symphony orchestra performers, are very well organized into unions. They decide how many rehearsals they're going to be and what hours they work and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So They play a role also in deciding on the repertory.
Well, I mean, there's 100 of them. They should probably have a role.
They should have a role, yes. But
all right, let me get Norman Lebrecht back in. Norman, I mean, the whole issue of that you brought up of, you know, state oversight, I mean, wouldn't that also happen in the private sector? Big corporation gives you, you know, some funding to do a series of concerts or something?
Absolutely it does. I agree with about 97% of what Larry was saying. Most of the big things that we do in arts, most of the new works that we commission couldn't possibly be done without state and corporate funding, or private funding. However, over the years we've seen the hand of the state and of individuals and of corporations gripping ever tighter on the premises that they fund. Larry is quite right. The United States government has never yet dictated what should be performed and how it should be performed, but it does provide you with forms that you have to tick, which dictate the ethnic composition of your organization. And if that doesn't meet certain quotas, then you are going to have an interesting conversation with government. Your corporate sponsors are every now and then going to tell you they want this and they don't want that. They want the traditional, they don't want the modern, and very often indeed, a private sponsor will tell you, no, she wants a production by Zeffirelli at the Met and nobody else. So, you know, there are these constraints on the arts, and these constraints are growing. And I think what we need is actually a new conversation. We need a new set of rules that prevail between arts organizations and those who fund them, whether it is the state or whether it is corporations or whether it is private individuals. We do need a new reassertion of the independence of the arts and the right of the arts to perform what they think of it.
Larry, what do you think about that? A new conversation, a new model?
I think provocative conversation is always a good thing, and I like the 97% agreement part very much.
but the devil is in the 3%.
I do believe, without being political here, John, that if you look at some of the alternative investments that the public sector makes with the money that it collects from us in taxes, the arts compare very favorably indeed.
All right. Well, this is obviously a conversation that we could take on for the rest of the afternoon, let alone the rest of the program. Let me just wrap up here and thank my three guests. Lawrence Goldman is president and CEO, chief executive of the New Jersey Performing Arts Center in Newark. Norman Lebrecht from the London Evening Standard, British cultural critic, and Alice Goldfarb Marquis, author of, among other books, Art Lessons, Learning from the Rise and Fall of Public Arts Funding. The new book is Art Czar, about Clement Greenberg. To the three of you, thank you so much for joining us on Soundcheck.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
If you have email that you'd like to send to us, want to weigh in on what we've been talking about so far on Soundcheck, you can reach us at the Soundcheck inbox, soundcheck@wnyc.org. Thanks for listening to Soundcheck from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Every day we dig into what's happening in music, and you can hear everything we do and check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. All of this is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.